720 WGN. Good evening, John Landecker. But I am not alone. No. Corey Ramore from the Chicago Tribune. Good evening, and welcome to another broadcast.
Hey, John. How are you on this rainy evening?
Oh, man. And a rainy day. My dog wouldn't go out.
Oh.
I was trying to... There were a couple of... It didn't totally stop raining, but it stopped being like this torrential downpour. And I take her to the door and she won't even... It was like, I open the door and nope, not going. Okay. Try it again later. Nope, not going. Yeah, there was a ton of rain. That's for sure. So how have you been? How's the family? What's going on?
Good. We're good. In fact, I'm so glad we're chatting now and not an hour ago, because an hour ago I had 11 10-year-olds inside my house running around crazy. So yeah, I was not thrilled with the rain either, but between raindrops, they decided to go outside and play wiffle ball. So they got outside for a little bit. But I guess that's the difference between dogs and 10-year-olds. 10-year-olds don't mind the rain.
They want to stomp their feet in it and maybe even find some mud if it's
exactly. So yes, we sent them all home sweaty and
dirty. Nice. Here, parents, come on, come and get this. Your kid's ready and he's really dirty. Yeah. Was he your son just having a party, or is it his birthday, or just normal activity?
If you don't mind me giving them a little plug. My son is on a travel baseball team here in Evanston, and they won their league championship, but they were like the Bad News Bears. Like, their season was terrible. And, you know, even the coaches were like, what are we doing here? We can't get the kids to listen to us. And somehow they rebounded and made it through the playoffs and knocked off the top ranked team and the fourth ranked team, and they were like the eighth ranked team, and they won their championship a week ago. So yeah, we're continuing the celebration. Yeah.
Congratulations. You said he's on a traveling team, right?
Yeah, but when we say travel, it's just like up and down, you know, the lakefront. It's not going to other states. We're not like, I know there are teams that are like super into it like that. We're not like that.
what's the name of the team? They have a name?
It's not really imposing, but it's the Evanston Orange Cats.
The Evanston Orange Cats. That sounds good.
Sound too threatening.
I feel a vibration of terror passing through me just as you say that. Oh, no, not the Evanston Orange Cats. They're bad. Those cats are bad.
I don't know how they got that name, because there are no Evanston Blue Cats or any other color cats, but that's what it is.
Corey Ramore from the Chicago Tribune, and there'll be more when we come back on 720 WGN. We got the newspaper person. That would be Corey Ramore from the Chicago Tribune. With John Landecker, it's 7:15 here at 720 WGN. Okay. Vintage. Oh, hello, Vintage. Hello. Is my pizza here? Oh.
I have some leftovers from all the children who are at our house, so I'm willing to share, John.
So the Vintage Chicago Tribune's, this particular article I've got in front of me, six activities people used to do in the city during the summer. And I was drawn to polo, which and you know, there was, and I don't know, my head was spinning about polo, this particular polo club or association or whatever it is, that a guy named Michael Butler, this was I think the original producer of Hair, the musical. And he was out there all the time. And then I look at your article, and maybe he was a descendant of, where is the guy's name? Who, Paul Butler. You right here. Oak Brook Polo Club, founded by Paul Butler in 1922.
So, right.
I mean, can't be just a coincidence, right?
Right. Oh, yeah. They're definitely related. Yeah. I know. Sometimes when it's a common last name, you're like, are they related? Yeah, yes, definitely.
They have to be because they're at the polo club. And let's face it. I mean, polo is not for the masses. As a matter of fact, I love this. You have this part of the Tribune reported, for the benefit of the ignorant. Thank you. Thank you.
Of which I was one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. Gosh. So tell us about this, polo club and how people in Chicago actually went out there or participated or watched it or were spectators. What's up with it?
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize that Chicago was like on the forefront of polo in the United States. I had no idea until I started digging into the archives. And the thing you mentioned about for the benefit of the ignorant, that came from the Tribune in 1879, where the Tribune was trying to explain to people like what polo was.
Yeah.
And they essentially described it as like, well, it's like a pickup game of hockey, except you're on horseback. So
yes, sort of.
Yeah. I guess that makes sense, but what I didn't realize with polo is they have these periods that are called chuckers, and I guess for each chucker, which is like 7 minutes or so each, they need to change horses, like as part of the rules. So you're right. Polo is not a game that anybody could play. Like you need to have a lot of money and horses and equipment and a lot of training because you're going really fast on horseback. And then you're like leaning over and hitting the ball. It's like croquet on horseback. And the interesting thing about Oak Brook Polo Club, which just closed this year, after it was founded in 1922.
Wow.
It was pretty much considered one of the oldest, if not the oldest, in the United States. From what I understand about polo, and I'm sure somebody out there is a polo expert, and so please forgive me, but it's like multiple football, like one polo field is like multiple football fields long, like six or seven football fields long. So, I mean, it's not the probably greatest spectator sport either, so you have to really want to go out there. But from what the other thing I understand is between chuckers or periods, they would encourage spectators to get out there and, you know, replace the divots, like tamp down the divots that were, you know, kicked up by the horses.
Well,
that's kind of interesting.
I got a suspicion that the horses were doing more to the field than just laying a divot here and there, you know.
As
horses and animals are wont to do. I would think you would really need all that room because you're running horses. It's not, these aren't human beings. And, you know, talk about the upper class aspect of this. Well, he's now King Charles, but when he was a prince, he was there September 5th, 1986 at this club.
Yes. Michael Butler personally invited then Prince Charles to come and play. And it was only because Sarah Ferguson's father decided to step back. He was supposed to be at this match at Oak Brook Polo Club. And when Prince Charles said, yes, I will definitely come, Sarah Ferguson's dad stepped away from the team. So Prince Charles would have a spot. But not everything went swimmingly during this polo match on September 5th, 1986 for then Prince Charles, because apparently there was a collision and England's star player fell off his horse and the prince also fell off his horse.
Oh boy.
It was like a little bit of scary. It was a little bit scary for a few minutes there, but the prince got up. Everybody was okay. The horses were okay, and they continued. So
yes,
but I thought there was a good saying. We had a quote in the paper that said, quote, it's not often you see people who won the genetic lottery embarrassing themselves in public. I just love that. I love it. Sums it up really well.
Won the genetic lottery. Yeah, that's a good expression. And there, look at that. Winner of the genetic lottery is now lying on the ground. He fell off his genetic horse and now he's on his way with his polo. I think it's a mallet, isn't it? Maybe not.
I think so. Yeah, it's like a longer handle.
Yes, because, right.
You know, it's like up on the horse. Yeah, it's essentially what it is. And I guess the ball is hard, but it's also very hard to hit the ball accurately, like when you're on horseback. That's why it's whoever is playing has to be a really good, really good equestrian, and also really good at striking the ball the right way.
Well, what a lead in to the next topic of what people, six activities people used to do in the city during the summer. When, okay, you got polo, you got horses, and you also have the rodeo, which I think I would love to go to the rodeo,
you know in the city. The same way, John. And for in the early 1920s, so like a century ago, this is what people did. They would go to the rodeo, and they were not only indoors at the Chicago Stadium, but also at Soldier Field. And it was just like, I'm sure there were also a lot of people at that time who were moving to the big city from, you know, farmland or from rural areas. Yep. So I think it definitely appealed to a crowd, but I'm with you. You know, we do so many amazing events and concerts and things in the city of Chicago. Why not a rodeo? Why not bring it back? And I know there's professional bull riding that'll come through every so often, but speaking as somebody who lived in Arizona for a while and loved going to the rodeo every year, I completely agree with you, John.
You know, I have something in my mind is telling me I interviewed somebody in the past couple of years who was involved with a rodeo that was going to be, oh boy, in the greater Chicagoland area. I can't focus in on it, but that, if I remember correctly, that was like a legitimate rodeo. We had this kid. Well, he really wasn't. He was a kid. He's with the rodeo, and he was like hyping it like crazy, and he had, you know, a twang and sounded like he was from Southern Texas or something. But yeah, they were within the sound of my voice. Let's put it that way. It still has some credibility as a traveling attraction, which I think is great. You know, and everybody can participate in it. And as a matter of fact, you said here in 1927, the Soldier Field hosted the World Championship Rodeo. Wow.
Yeah. And it wasn't just open to white people. Black people, Native Americans were welcomed in rodeo competitions at a time when they weren't in other sports and other activities in the city. So talk about a way to bring people together. And I think this one's an interesting one for sure. And who knows? Maybe it'll happen. Maybe they'll bring it back.
Well, you know, we have a text line, 312-917-200. I got a text from 630 says, the average person could attend polo at the Brook Polo Club. This person went there. It was fun. They hadn't closed. Also, Sunny Acres in West Chicago has a rodeo each summer, according to
this
text.
Oh, this is great to know. Yeah. Sunny Acres. So I'm familiar
That's
with
it.
Sunny Acres.
That was from, it. That's who
was
I talked
it?
To.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Because I'm familiar with their pumpkin patch, but I didn't know they do rodeo.
Yeah, exactly.
We both learned something. Yeah.
They're multifaceted, those people. and, you know, I don't know if we're going to be able to get to all of this before we take a break at the bottom of the hour, but the Lollapalooza is getting underway. And you have in your article the backstory of a Chicagoland music festival. When was that?
Oh, my gosh. So part of the reason, just to give you a tiny bit of a backstory, part of the reason I wanted to put this together is I realized how we have so many amazing photos in the Chicago Tribune's archives, and they don't see the light of day because they're things that happened in the past. So I'm like, let's bring some of these to light again. And the Chicagoland Music Festival is one of those things, like you said, it happened every single year, and people showed up and sang, and different groups would come. I mean, we're talking about 150,000 people in Soldier Field.
Man. Yes. I wonder why it stopped. It seems to me like that would be a going, you know, a successful enterprise. I mean, take a look at Lollapalooza, you know.
Right, right. And I think the inaugural one was in 1930. Wow. And it just, I don't know exactly what happened to make it stop, but it went for decades. I mean, at least until the 60s, maybe even the 70s.
Well, I guess everybody knows Colonel Robert McCormick. He really liked it, according to your article, and wasn't shy about promoting. It was sponsored by the Trib, right?
Yes. Amazing. It was sponsored by the Trib. And, you know, it was at a time, yes, you mentioned Colonel McCormick.
Yeah.
I mean, the Tribune reporters basically had to rewrite the English language according to whatever Colonel McCormick said, however he wanted them to spell words. So, I mean, everybody kind of operated under that scope of what does the Colonel want?
Yes.
But the cool thing about it is the Tribune is also responsible for getting baseball's All-Star Game started in 1933. I mean, there are things that we do now that are no longer associated with the Chicago Tribune that were started by the Chicago Tribune. The All-Star Game is the biggest example I can think of offhand, but the Tribune would also sponsor summer and winter sports competitions, Silver Skate, some people might be familiar with in the winter time. So yeah, it was really a way to bring people together. And yes, you're right. Within the pages of the Tribune, events like this were promoted relentlessly, which is part of why we have so many photos for it. But when you're talking about an event that included Louis Armstrong, Frankie Avalon, Mahalia Jackson. I mean, this is part of the history I'm so glad that we still have access to within our archives.
Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune, the Vintage Tribune, going through the archives, and we're not done yet. We'll be back. But right now it's the bottom of the hour. Time to get into the WGN newsroom. Hey, speaking of newspapers, what do you know? 720 WGN, I'm John Landecker with Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune. And we're talking about an article in the Vintage Tribune. There are a number of activities that you list here that Chicagoans used to do. A floating hospitals. That really caught my attention. What is that about? I mean, how would that be a summer activity? I mean, who wants to go to the hospital in the summer? You know what I mean?
I mean, it was really interesting. It was called a sanitarium.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they were actually along Lake Michigan. In fact, the most recognizable one that people might recognize is the former theater on the lake in Lincoln Park.
Sure.
If you drive on Lakeshore Drive.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was called the Chicago Daily News Fresh Air Fund Sanitarium. They actually raised money to have a place where people with tuberculosis other diseases, where the belief was if you get a lot of fresh air, it'll help clear that out. And so, people used to go to the lakefront in the summer and, practically year round for that reason, to go to one of these sanitariums in hopes to get better.
But you say here it's a floating hospital. In the summer, did they actually go out onto the lake?
They wouldn't go onto the lake, but they were near piers on Lake Michigan is where these were mostly built, from what I understand. And so I don't know if they were ever supposed to be permanent, or if this one just survived because it was on such a great plot of land. But yeah, the most recognizable one is in Lincoln Park.
Amazing. Yeah, I know where that theater used to be, at any rate, the theater on the lake. Those activities are uplifting, and there's something else that happened. Something else that happened on this day in history that is certainly not, but everybody in Chicago knows about the Eastland disaster and the aftermath. I mean, this is like public knowledge. It's 110 years ago today that occurred. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Let's see. What was it? It was July 24th. So it was last week.
Whoops,
that's okay. Don't worry about it. Yeah, it was just last week. The SS Eastland, one of the things I didn't realize is, you know, formerly in the summer, a lot of Chicagoans would get on a boat and they would go to either Indiana or to Michigan or sometimes to Wisconsin on a day trip. It was an excursion. So you'd get on the boat and then you'd get off the boat at the destination and have a picnic or whatever, and then get on the boat and come back. And that was the idea with the SS Eastland when it was chartered by Western Electric Company on July 24th, 1915. It was kind of like a picnic for employees and their families, even though I read that the families had to buy their own tickets. And there were threats that apparently if they didn't buy tickets to go to this event, that it could affect their job. So a lot of people signed up, some 2,500 people signed up to do it. And so the SS Eastland was one of the boats that was chartered to take people to go to Michigan City, Indiana, which was considered the Coney Island of the Midwest, apparently. At
the the Coney Island of the Midwest is Michigan City, Indiana. Why don't they have that as the, you know, if you're driving by the exit to get to Michigan City on 94, why don't they have that on a sign?
I mean, just I'm
this
with
way,
you.
The Coney Island, yes, the Midwest. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. My kiddo and I just drove through there last weekend. And so it's like, yeah, that would make me want to stop and go there. So
did they, wait a minute, did they have like rides and games in Michigan City at the time?
Apparently it was like amazing. Where you wanted to go, if it was somewhere close to home. And I know some families still vacation in Michigan City.
Oh, sure.
Indiana, but yeah, the Coney Island of the Midwest, that's the term that I found in the Tribune. That's what we were calling it back then.
Yeah. And people from Chicago would, still do come to Michigan City, and then also right across the state line in New Buffalo.
Yes. Michigan.
There's tons of summer homes, and this time of year, all the ice cream parlors are packed. And, there's only one, but still, Oinks, that's the name of it. Oinks, I was searching for the name of this ice cream store. A great place if you're ever around New Buffalo. It's called Oinks. Okay. Where were we? We were in New Buffalo. Yeah. So this was, it's still a summer destination for a lot of Chicagoans, but not by boat. I think that would be so great.
Yes.
To go across Lake Michigan.
Yeah, I've often wondered why there aren't boats that do this. I know there's a ferry that will take people from Wisconsin. You can drive your car onto the ferry and you can go from Wisconsin to Michigan and vice versa.
Right.
Yeah, so I was kind of curious why people stopped doing this. And I have to remember, this was in 1915. This is before people had cars of their own. This is before a highway system was built. So I think it's easier for people nowadays just to drive or far enough you can fly. But yeah, this is how people would get around back in early 1900s. And so it makes sense to say, hey, why don't you meet us at this dock and we will charter the boat and we'll go there for the day. And so that's what happened when the Eastland, and as I mentioned, 2,500 people were boarding the Eastland and the ship was not stable. And what happened is it ended up kind of rocking back and forth and listing, and it eventually overturned. And it was still partially connected to the dock on the Chicago River between LaSalle Drive and Clark Street. And so it tipped over, and immediately thousands of people are either in the Chicago River or they're trapped inside of this boat and they can't get out. And so the rescue effort began, but ultimately 840 some people died. It's one of the biggest tragedies in Chicago's history. And when we're talking about the Great Chicago Fire, I think there were 300 some people who died in the Great Chicago Fire. So 800, I mean, this was a huge maritime disaster. It was the deadliest day in Chicago. And one of the greatest losses of life during peacetime on a waterway in the United States. And so before I moved back to Chicago 12 years ago, I really didn't know much about the Eastland. And I think in more recent years, people have become educated about it. But there were some 20-some families who were just wiped out that day as a result of this disaster. One person who was supposed to be aboard this boat was George Halas. He, the owner, we now know him as the owner of the Chicago Bears, the founder, one of the founders of the NFL. He was supposed to be aboard the ship because he was working that summer for Western Electric. And I've seen different reasons. Either he overslept or he was working out and couldn't get there in enough time. But in the Chicago Tribune, George Halas's name actually appeared as one of the victims in the early days following the what we call the Eastland disaster.
How could that be? Why would they, if he wasn't even there, why would they put his name in?
His name must have been on a you know, some sort of passenger list somewhere that he bought a ticket and was supposed to go. That's what I assume happened in that situation. But I think it became pretty clear, you know, not long after it happened that thankfully George Halas was alive and well. But I mean, there's a chance the Chicago Bears would have never happened if we had lost George Halas. So you know, it's definitely a terrible day in Chicago history, but one not a lot of people know about.
Wasn't there some, I may be totally wrong, some scandal attached to this in some way? The Eastland?
Yes. As it turned out, the boat operators really didn't know much, if anything, about how to operate a boat safely. They were more concerned about making money off the boat. Mm-hmm. And apparently the boat had known issues where it was not stable. It was not sturdy and shouldn't have been used to have that many people aboard. So there was actually a coroner's inquiry, and there was a case that held six people. Took six people to trial. I think it was in Grand Rapids, Michigan was the trial. But ultimately, the judge decided no one person in particular could be pointed out for being the cause of this problem, since the six people who were named, none of them were on the boat the day of the disaster. So unfortunately, nobody was ever prosecuted for this. And the boat, in case you're wondering whatever happened to the Eastland, it was eventually bought by the U.S. Navy and was converted into the USS Wilmette and was used for training in Lake Michigan. And so the boat was around for a long time. And then eventually after World War II, I think it was sold for scrap. Wow. So, pretty fascinating history.
This is very fascinating, and that's why we like having you on, and we'll do more when we come back on 720 WGN. Yeah, and I'm John Landecker. Thank you for tuning in at 749. And we're talking to Corey Moore from the Chicago Tribune and Vintage Chicago Tribune. And I am on the right date now. So July 30th is the correct date, John. You are. Congratulations, John. You found the right date. Thank you. So on this date in 1971, the Union Stockyards closed on the South Side. Now, before you get into it, and this may just be something in my head that is there that has no connection with reality, but I was looking for a version of my kind of town, Chicago Is, by Frank Sinatra, because he says, Chicago Is, the Union Stockyard, Chicago. There were a number of Frank Sinatra online, and I mean, and none of them had that in it. So maybe I'm just, just like crazy.
It wouldn't be the Lou Rawls version. Does Lou Rawls say it in his version? I'm trying to think of other singers I've heard sing the song.
Or maybe I'm confusing it with something else. But there was somebody mentioned the Union Stockyards in some song about Chicago. I'm pretty sure. But in 1970, it closed.
I feel the same way, though. I feel like I've heard that sung as part of that song before.
Right. Well, we shall see. So they had more than 18.6 million head of cattle, hogs, and sheep that were marketed at its peak in 1924. Wow.
Were they
operating as, you know, Union Stockyards until 1971? Were they still processing, you know, cattle and pork and all of that?
Yes. Wow. From the story that I found in our archives, it sounds like it was at a much smaller capacity in the later years.
Yeah.
So, yeah, 1924 was like heyday for it. Right. The Union Stockyards opened, I believe it was the day after Christmas in 1865. Like, somebody figured out, okay, let's bring all these animals to market.
Right.
But then also let's process them there as well. Because I guess that wasn't really common, because if you processed them and you didn't have refrigeration, the meat would go bad. Yeah. So in early years, it was, you know, okay, auction, and then the animals are going to go out from here to whoever purchased them. But as things progressed, somebody was like, Swift. Yeah, it was the Swift company that said, hey, you know, refrigerated cars will help us get this, you know, process it on site in addition to selling it on site. So
I also have a slogan in the back of my head, something like Chicago Hog Butcher to the World.
Exactly. Hog Butcher to the World. I think, if I remember right, doesn't that come from the jungle? I think that comes from Upton Sinclair's
Yes, it does. Wow. Listen to us talking about Upton Sinclair. Oh,
I'm sure there's somebody out. No, I'm sorry. I got to take it back. It's from Carl Sandburg.
Carl Sandburg. Right.
I'm sure somebody out there was thinking that, like, no, Corey, you've got it all wrong. So thankfully, I figured it out.
I got a text from 708 that says, yes, the Union Stockyards was in the Chicago song. My dad used to take me to the stock show at the stockyards in the 1950s. Thank you for the text, 708. I also want to make sure we get to this on the anniversary, that in what happened in at noon, 1974, Corey? What happened?
At noon. Oh, my gosh. Something that is everywhere today.
Yeah.
You could start to buy the very first Illinois State Lottery tickets in 1974. And it's hilarious because we have a photo in the Tribune of Dan Walker, who was the governor at the time, and how he was counting out $12 to buy 24 lottery tickets. It's so funny because I think he eventually went to prison. He was one of the Illinois governors who went to prison. So to see him like buying lottery tickets, only in Illinois, right?
Yeah. You know, the prison's got a whole wing devoted to Illinois governors.
This is true.
Just about. Yeah, you're right. Dan Walker, man, that brings back... he walked the state of Illinois.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
Yes, he did with his son. Yes, he did.
Wow. 7.5 million tickets. Were that's how many were sold on the first day? 7.5 million?
Well, they started to sell them on July 30th, 1974, but the first drawing didn't take place until August 8th.
Well, right.
I think the excitement level was huge for this in the state of Illinois. And we weren't the first to get a state lottery, and we definitely weren't the last, but it was a big development. And seeing as how now today you can have an app on your phone for sports betting, you can go to a casino in the city of Chicago.
Right.
I mean, to see how far this has come, it's pretty fascinating.
It really is. You know, I was working here in 1974, and I have a distinct memory of Dan Walker, but I don't know why I don't have a clear memory of the Illinois lottery starting. Maybe because I don't buy lottery tickets, but still, it must have been an unbelievably big event in 1974.
Covered it like crazy. We covered it when there was a little mom and pop coffee shop that received the first license from the state to sell lottery tickets. Wow. The Illinois State Lottery had like a mobile vehicle that would go around and you could buy tickets from it. So yeah, it was a huge deal back then.
Yeah. And it's still a huge deal. I mean, now it's like every gas station, every convenience store, you know, step up and buy some lottery tickets. Way back in 1974. Also, in 1977, you report one of the great achievements. You know, we were mentioning George Halas, the Chicago Bears earlier. The Kansas Comet, Gale Sayers, inducted into the Pro Football Hall of Fame.
That's the cool thing about July is seeing, I believe there are 32 former Chicago Bears players currently who have been enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And so each day somebody is a little different. And if you check out tomorrow's Today in Chicago History on ChicagoTribune.com, you'll see someone arguably even, I don't want to say he's better than Gale Sayers because Gale Sayers was amazing, but one of the most recognizable Chicago Bears of all time was enshrined in the Hall of Fame.
Listen, he had this quote of his, which is really fantastic. Reaching this point is not as great as striving to get there. It's not enough to settle for yesterday's triumphs. Gale Sayers. Yeah. I just want to tell you, too, somebody has texted me a link to a version of My Kind of Town from a movie that Frank Sinatra was in, Robin and the Seven Hoods. Warner Brothers Archive. What time is it? 7:50. Can I play this on the air, do you think? If it's sitting right down the computer?
Yes, well, do it.
Listen to you. Sound like this. Okay, here we go.
So may I say to each of you most gratefully, as I throw each one of you a kiss.
Thanks, Frank.
This is my kind of town. Chicago is my kind of town. Chicago is
cut.
My kind of people too.
You know, we're not going to get to all of it, but maybe later. But thank you, whoever texted that in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, that's
Corey,
so great.
You know, what should we do to obtain the vintage Chicago Tribune, by the way?
Oh, well, I have Today in Chicago History every day on ChicagoTribune.com. So as I mentioned, go to the website and you'll see tomorrow's. And if you want to get my newsletter, it comes out twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays. And you can just go to ChicagoTribune.com/newsletters and sign up for mine. It's the one that says Vintage Chicago Tribune, and it's totally free. Much as I appreciate anybody who has a Tribune subscription, newsletter's totally free. So I'd love to have you sign up and send me some tips, some things you'd like to see in it.
Very nice. All right. Thank you again for coming on, Corey, and have a great night and say congratulations to the kids there for the baseball victory. And I'll talk to you soon, I hope.
Oh, I hope so too, John. Thank you so much.
You bet.